Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, is it possible to transform global energy use to create a clean, prosperous, and secure energy future by making the shift from fossil fuels to energy efficiency and renewables by 2050 or even sooner? Well, Emory Lovins, the author of Reinventing Fire, says yes. And he's here in Chapel Hill to explain to us how that seemingly impossible task can be made possible. It's a ridiculous claim, isn't it? Well, but first of all, no, before I start attacking you, welcome to Chapel Hill, and thanks for coming and spending so much time with us. You had a few days ago, a few nights ago, your name in lights at the Varsity Theater and had a crowd explore with you. These claims and the hopefulness that you bring to the energy situation.
Yeah, great crowd, and thank all for coming out. And no, it is not a ridiculous claim. And if any energy business thinks so, all I can say is I love to have competitors who think like that. Marshall McLuhan said, only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries, he said, are protected by public incredulity. But this particular finding actually goes further than can we run the economy on three-quarters renewable energy with tripled efficiency in 2050 and keep the lights on and keep the economy humming. Actually, we found you could do that with a 2.6-fold bigger economy than now, using no oil, no coal, no nuclear energy, at least a third less natural gas, and it would cost $5 trillion less than business as usual, assuming that all hidden or external costs are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. We also found this could be done with no new inventions and no act of Congress.
A lot of people would be interested in that last part more.
The transition led by business for profit. Well, it's a pretty simple idea. If you're relying on America's most dynamic and effective institutions, that is private enterprise co-evolving with civil society and sped by military innovation, then you can do an end run around our least effective institutions.
So, I mean, the excitement that you generate with those who are in line with or believe the projections and the work that you've done is that we can avoid the political disputes that go with carbon offset taxes or some sort of government-imposed economic model. You believe that all of this can be done pretty much by market, by people doing what is economically in their best interest.
Yes. If you have some policies that are rather light-handed, no new taxes, subsidies, mandates, and they're almost all at a state level where we've long made most of our energy policy anyway, and it's not to make people do stuff, it's to reward what we want, not the opposite. For example, reward utilities for cutting your bill, not selling you more energy. Reward architects and engineers for what they save, not what they spend. That doesn't take a law at all. You just do it. if you're going to buy a new automobile, you should be able to get a rebate for buying one more efficient than normal in the size you want, or pay a fee for buying one less efficient than normal, and the fees pay for the rebates. You have plenty of choice, but you are then able to take the long view of 15 years of fuel savings, which is what society's interested in.
We talked about the government not doing anything, but you've outlined some choices that somebody's got to provide the incentives to give rebates to those who buy efficient, fuel efficient.
Paid for by fees on those who impose extra costs on society, because we pay $2 billion a day for oil, but we pay also $4 billion a day for the hidden economic and military costs of our oil dependence. And as an advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, I see some of those costs in both blood and treasure.
Well, give us an outline. You put a target date of 2050 for a transformation of our energy generation and use.
Yep, and it's right on target so far.
Give us your TED Talk about that, about how that worked.
Well, to get there and make it $5 trillion cheaper, you just take economics seriously. You do the cheapest things first. And that starts with how we use energy. There are two big stories here, oil and electricity, each of which, by the way, puts about two-fifths of the fossil carbon in the air. Those two stories are less than 1% connected right now, but they're similarly concentrated in their uses. That is, three-quarters of the oil runs transport, three-quarters of the electricity powers buildings.
Well, just to, I think this is real simple, but somehow or another, just to be sure, your view is, or your numbers show that 70% of the oil that we use right now runs cars and trucks and other airplanes and other vehicles of transport. And
right.
So that's a large amount if you can work on doing it some other way. And then you focus on electricity as being the other big user of power.
And that's three-quarters buildings, one-quarter industry.
75% buildings and then 75% of running machines and things like that.
Yeah.
And those are the two big places where we as a country use
practically
energy.
Practically the only place.
And how do you see reducing or the reliance on those forms of energy?
Well, you start by using energy in a way that saves money. So we can triple or quadruple by 2050 the energy efficiency of our buildings with savings that are worth four times what they cost. So this will save us.
Give us an illustration.
It'll save us $1.4 trillion net, and for any business listeners, that's a 33% internal rate of return. Really juicy. How do you do it? Well, I'll give you the Empire State Building as an example. We're saving there two-fifths of the energy on retrofit with a three-year payback.
I don't understand what that means. I mean, saving two-fifths? Break that down and explain it to us.
Yeah, the Empire State Building is now using two-fifths less energy than it used before our 2010 retrofit. And they got their investment back in 3 years.
What does the retrofit involve? Why does it cost so much, and why is that cost worthwhile?
Well, we took all the thousands of windows and remanufactured them on site into super windows that insulate four times better and are almost perfect in letting in light but blocking heat. And those plus better lights and office equipment and fans and other stuff let us cut the peak cooling load on the hottest afternoons by a third. But then we could renovate smaller chillers rather than adding bigger chillers. That saved, those are the giant refrigerators that air-conditioned buildings. That saved $17 million of capital cost, which paid for most of the savings I've just described, and reduced the payback time to just 3 years. We've just done a similar deep retrofit in a big federal complex, half a century old in Denver, quite a difficult building, faces the wrong way and so on. And we're saving 70% of the energy there cost effectively, making it more efficient than the best new office in the country built 4 years ago. And now three weeks ago, we broke ground on our own new office, which will be about twice as efficient as that one. So the state of the art keeps moving. And think about it a real simple way. I live near Aspen, Colorado, 7,100 feet up in the Rocky Mountains, where it used to go to minus 47 on occasion. Now it only goes to minus 30-odd. In the middle of my house, I've grown so far 55 banana crops, and I don't have a heating system. Why not? Well, I doubled the normal amount of insulation and put in windows that insulate like 16 sheets of glass, but look like two and cost less than three, thanks to atomically thin miracle coatings inside. And therefore, the heat comes in as light, but it can't get out. So the building heats itself. We used to have a 50-watt dog as a portable supplementary space heater, and she was normally rated at 50 watts, but if you threw the ball, you could crank her up to about 100. And it turns out it's a little cheaper to build this way because we saved more construction costs by not putting in a heating system than we paid for the super insulation and super windows and ventilation heat recovery that let us do that. I then reinvested that money plus some more into super efficient lights and appliances and ended up saving 99% of my space and water heating energy, 90% of my household electricity. So when I moved in 84, the bill was $5 a month before we went solar. That's 4,000 square feet of home and office. And I got my money back in 10 months, but today's technologies are a lot better.
Well, you're describing such a exciting and almost miraculous transformation that you've made in your with your own buildings or with those that you are consulting with others. Why isn't everybody doing this now? Why is it going to take 35 years to get?
Well, because we got a zillion buildings, all different shapes and sizes and ownership. A lot of them are owned by different people than pay the bills. And you got to train a lot of people how to do what I just described. It's called integrative design that makes big savings cheaper than small savings because you're optimizing the whole building as a system, not the components in isolation. And that isn't yet taught in our engineering and architecture schools. So it comes as a surprise. It gives you, you know, expanding returns, not diminishing returns.
The market is picking up very quickly on this. Opportunities to save as much money as you're talking about.
They do. And indeed, this country has been shrinking its electric demand and its gasoline demand, by the way, for 7 years now as the economy grows, because people are picking up on these opportunities. But to get through all the stuff we built wrong is going to take several decades just because it's a lot of work.
We're visiting with Amory Lovins, who's the author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. He and I'll be right back. Back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm stunned by the assertions that Amory Lovins, the author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era, is presenting me with, both in terms of what he's accomplished factually and then what he projects that our country or the people in our country and the people of the world can do with respect to energy. Can I call you Amory, or you can, or Dr. Lovins?
Amory is fine.
And the, you know, there are two things that are stunning about your report to us. One is that all of a sudden, out of sort of a hopeless idea that our generation and the generations that follow us immediately are trapped into an unsolvable problem in terms of being able to supply enough energy for the increasing demands, and that we can't do this without handcuffing ourselves and wrapping ourselves in government regulations, which our people are not willing to accept. And then the idea that whatever we do is going to be extraordinarily expensive. And then you come along like a prophet and say, don't worry, we have the capability to transform our society, both in terms of our usage of energy, and then in terms of finding other ways to generate it that are not as expensive or almost free. So don't worry, by 2050, we'll be in good shape.
If we take markets seriously, if we pick the best buys, if we enable the new energy system instead of defending the old one and trying to block competition, which, of course, the incumbents sometimes want to do, because change is uncomfortable, change is scary. But you don't really have much choice in this one. You know, the world is investing in each of the past 3 years $250 billion in modern renewables to add 80 billion watts of them every year or more. Well, that annual investment in modern renewables is more than the total market cap of the world coal industry. You know, the revolution already happened.
Just to be clear, what are you talking about in terms of renewals? Wind, solar, what else?
Wind, solar, some small hydro, some geothermal, some waste product combustion. I'm not counting big hydro in that, but that's mm-hmm. another mm-hmm. sizable chunk. And actually, if you add up all renewables, including big hydro, and cogeneration, combined heat and power in industry and buildings, and energy efficiency, which is over a $300 billion investment every year in the world, that's over $600 billion of investment. Probably more than we're spending on conventional power plants. And the orders for coal and nuclear plants are drying up around the world because they have no business case.
Well, you're saying this can be done by market rather than by government. Do you contemplate government investment in some of these enterprises?
I think there is a role for government R&D to get public goods, but our analysis only assumed existing technologies, no new inventions, even though we're going to have a lot of good ones. You may notice that the military is the national leader in buying renewable energy, partly to save money and stabilize their costs so they're not whipsawed by fuel prices going up and down like a yo-yo. And mostly because their strategy for powering military bases is networks, microgrids of mainly renewable on-site resources that can work with or without the grid. And there are modern industry-agreed standards for hooking them up so that your base and the communities around it where your people live keep working even if the grid goes down. By the way, my own house works that way. Well, the Pentagon does this because they need their stuff to work, but so do the rest of us whom they're defending. And they look at the cyber and physical vulnerabilities of the grid, not to mention storms, squirrels, tree limbs, and all the other stuff that brings down the grid from time to time. And they say, we cannot let our mission continuity depend on such a brittle, fragile, vulnerable resource. Mm-hmm. We got to have our own power from a diverse portfolio of renewables that'll keep going no matter what so we can do our mission.
So, I mean, if the military is willing to do that even if it costs more, but you're saying that they can save money too.
Yes, they're actually finding excellent economics, and some of the bases are saving many millions of dollars a year.
How does it work on a military base?
Well, you got to sometimes rewire what you got because the old way of putting in renewables like, you know, geothermal at China Lake or photovoltaics at Nellis Air Force Base is you sell the power over the fence to the utility and then buy it back. But that way, if the utility's grid goes down, so do you. So we're having to rejig both the contracts and sometimes the wiring to keep the power on the base, just like I do in my house. And if I have some left over, I run the meter backwards. I actually provide more benefit to the utility than they pay me for. They're making a lot on the deal, just like Duke Energy probably is here in North Carolina. Then when the grid goes down, of course, I'm in business. I wrote that book on my tower computer with no uninterruptible power supply because my house is one. We had 5 power failures in February alone. I never lost a byte of data.
And what is your fallback position when your sustainable energy level, solar or wind or whatever you're using, isn't working? Because those energy supply sources also go down from time to time.
Well, the way it normally works is that I make solar energy in the daytime, sell back the surplus, and I buy wind power from my utility at night. And they have a diversified enough grid and steady enough wind that, on balance, I will always be getting wind power. They are creating at least as much new wind power as I'm buying, even though the electrons don't have a label on them. Now, the bigger question you're asking is a really important one because, of course, a lot of folks think that you need giant batteries to store lots of electricity when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow. And it turns out that's not right. That's not how grids work. And the proof of the pudding is that in Spain last year, 45% of their electricity consumption was renewable. In Scotland, 46%. In Denmark, 50%. In Portugal, 58%, up from 17% 9 years ago. How do they do it? The same way a conductor leads a symphony orchestra, no instrument plays all the time, but the orchestra continually produces beautiful music. That is, they back up the variable renewables, which are photovoltaics and wind, with other renewables of other kinds or in other places. And you can also, of course, use electricity more flexibly at different times if you have better information about what it costs at different times. You can do distributed storage in smart electric vehicles and in ice storage air conditioning, for example. In the Midwest, they even ship data around through fiber optics from one data center to another wherever the wind's blowing, and use that as a method of demand response. And when you put all these pieces together with the dispatchable renewables, the ones you can have whenever you want, which is all the other kinds, well, that's an awfully long
list. What are the ones that you can have anytime?
Small hydro, geothermal, solar thermal electric, which stores heat to run into or through the night, burning municipal solid waste, burning, say, biogas or biomass wastes, burning obsolete energy studies. It's a pretty big list. When you add it all up, we found that this whole portfolio stuff could run the isolated Texas grid. It's a hard case, not connected to the rest of the country, 100% on renewables without adding bulk storage, just as these European countries have not added bulk storage. And guess what? Their power is more reliable than ours. In Denmark and Germany, which is a quarter renewable, it's 10 times as reliable as ours.
Well, before we take a break, I want to get back to the question I asked you earlier about your house.
Yeah.
Which is, which you said operate even when the grid went down, you're in good shape.
Yes.
And so what and you don't have any wind power, or you said that you got wind power from your utility. How do you operate when the grid goes down?
If the grid goes down, so I cannot get the night wind power, because in the daytime I got solar, in that case, I do have a chunk of batteries. Let's see, it's about the size of, I'm not sure what to compare it with, a big chest of drawers or
not a whole room.
No, and it'll last indefinitely because I don't run it up and down every night. I don't store solar power to use at night. That's when I buy the utility wind power, because that would wear out the batteries faster and lose some power going in and out. But the batteries are sitting there always fully charged, so that if I lose the grid at night when I would otherwise buy wind power, then I run off the batteries instead. But remember, my house is using much less electricity than normal. Therefore, I don't need that many batteries or that many solar cells. And it's really fun to watch your meter spin backwards.
So you can fill up, just say you're permanently disconnected to the grid. You can fill up your battery during the day when the solar power is operating.
Yes,
and then use, being careful, you can use what power you need in the evening from your
batteries.
Yes,
and the grid could go down indefinitely or permanently through cyber attack or physical attack or solar storm, for which the grid is not prepared. One of them just missed us in the last year or two. And therefore, my batteries are sized for indefinitely running the house. And, you know, when we get a big snow and ice storm and all the neighbors' lights are out, I call up the local emergency services and say, y'all want to come on over and recharge your radio batteries? We got juice.
You got to do it. Well, now, help us with another conception that we have, and that is that during the winter, the sun's not out all the time. It's not out. It's only out, you know, really above the ground for a few hours a day. And is that enough?
Yeah. If you're efficient, it's enough. Now, where I live, we have had as long as 39 continuous days of midwinter cloud. It's an often sunny climate, but the mountains make their own weather up at 7,100 feet. If you don't like the weather, you wait 5 minutes. So we have designed for that too. Efficiency is not static. It's definitely a moving target. The new technologies are so much better than the ones that saved 90% of our electricity 32 years ago with about a 10-month payback, that we've retrofitted darn near everything. And we're now measuring the new technologies to see how much better they are. Y'all understand there wasn't a business case for retrofitting because we were using hardly anything to start with. But we wanted to see how much better they were. And the trouble is our lights and appliances now seem to be using less electricity than the equipment that's measuring how little they use. It's a nice problem to have.
That's great. Well, we're visiting with Amory Lovins, who is the author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Healy and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Amory Lovins, who is the author of Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era, and he's been in Chapel Hill explaining to some of us exactly how he can defend a claim that he and his colleagues have made that we can be virtually self-sufficient with energy and without the use of oil and coal, maybe a little bit of natural gas, but otherwise mostly sustainable energy combined with some very strong but reasonable restrictions on our use and on the development of more efficient machinery that uses power.
I wasn't suggesting restrictions, actually.
Oh, yeah, restrictions is a bad word.
I'm suggesting greater choice and more informed choice.
Yeah, no, I guess when I was using restrictions, I was being as careful as I could not to talk about anybody imposing anything on anybody, but self-restrictions in terms like at your house.
Well, enlightened self-interest.
Right, but you make a choice not to use the kinds of things that use a lot of power.
Let me give you a simple example. We recently put some piping in our house, and I spent a half hour teaching our master plumber how to do low-friction pipe layout, laying out pipes as if they were all drains, even though they're supply pipes. He never thought of that before. It's basically using fat, short, straight pipes instead of skinny, long, crooked pipes. He wanted to put in seven pumps totaling over 2,000 watts. We ended up needing one pump of 43 watts because we designed out 97% of the friction. And guess what? It costs less. Less pipe, fewer joints, less labor. Got rid of six pumps, made the other one teensy. So it all costs less. And we have done the same in industry. Savings are typically, even on retrofit, 80 or 90%. And that's a big deal because pumps are the biggest use of motors in the world. And motors use 3/5 of all the electricity.
Well, is that how in my house, which is not designed like yours, but it's an ordinary house, 50 years old. It's not pumps that it's using all the energy, is it? Or is it?
No, although if you have a circulating pump moving hot water from a furnace or boiler around your house, it runs a lot in the winter, and that is a surprisingly big use. The European Union figures if we made those efficient and the right size using stuff that's all on the market and has great economics, you would meet something like a third of the carbon reduction target Europe has set.
Well, you mentioned you wanted to share with us some of the experience that some industrial activities have had in applying some of these same common sense ideas.
Yeah, well, I'll mention both a traditional, let me mention actually two high-tech industries, the kinds that North Carolina is trying to build and attract. In a chip-making plant, a chip fab for Texas Instruments, we saved a lot of energy and water, but we also saved 30% of the capital cost, or $230 million, which is why that plant got built in Texas, not China.
How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, fat, short, straight pipes was a big chunk of it, and laying things out better, and turning off vacuum pumps or turning them down when you don't need them through a new control protocol. When you added up all the stuff we did for efficiency, it made the equipment supplying chilled water, clean water, air, stuff like that, so much smaller that it only needed one floor, not two. Big chunk of capital cost went away. An even more fun example is a data center that we helped EDS design as they were becoming part of Hewlett-Packard, you know, Ross Perot's firm. It went in the north of England, and the client was so conservative they would not allow EDS to put in most of our recommendations, so we could only triple the efficiency at the same cost. But EDS said, had we been allowed to put in all your good ideas that we agree with, we would have saved 95% of the energy and half the capital cost.
Well, that, you know, all of this leads us back to the same question. You say all this can be transformed by 2050, but the choices that you've outlined are so stark and so so much of a return so quickly that it seems like it's just crazy that people aren't standing in line to make these transformations now.
Well, a lot of businesses are, but it's not that easy. For example, there are 21 parties in the commercial real estate value chain. And with stunning perfection, each of them is systematically rewarded for inefficiency and penalized for efficiency.
So how do you change that without some kind of dramatic government activity to reform the way the market works?
Partly through financial innovation. For example, some utilities, and they're even required to do this in California and New York, but they know it's a good deal.
Again, the government requirements.
Yeah, but they know it's a good deal, so they'd probably do it anyway, are offering on-bill financing for efficiency and passing along their low cost of capital, and you're reducing their costs and risks. We have done 5 experiments with performance-based design fees, where you pay your designers for savings, not expenditures. That has a very salutary effect on design. That doesn't take any laws. If you're buying design services, you know you're going to get designers who will stand behind high-efficiency design because they get penalized if they don't perform and rewarded if they overperform. And if you're an architect or an engineer, you would want to bid your job that way because you will distinguish yourself in a crowded market and you want smart clients.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is your life, and your colleagues are assembled there. Sort of, I gather it's sort of your family of people who preach this gospel.
And very, very capable colleagues. There's about 100 of us. This is not just me. We've been at it 32 years, making long game, big changes in complex systems, and working in equal depth in all 4 sectors that use energy, that is transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity, and then linking them together. So we are an independent, entrepreneurial, 8 spinoff so far, nonprofit, public benefit, think and do tank. The important word is and. And we work largely with the private sector because we want to get stuff done. We don't lobby. We don't litigate. Occasionally, we help governments. Like right now, we are actually helping the central government of China overhaul their energy policy in collaboration with their top energy shops. And that's going very nicely. We figured out together how to get about 15 times more economic work out of each unit of fossil carbon and make money on the deal.
Well, how does it operate economically for you all? Do you seek grants from businesses, or do you do contracts with people who believe that your expertise can help save them money? How does all that work?
Cumulatively, we have earned 43% of all our revenue in 32 years by what we call programmatic enterprise, that is, activities that are entrepreneurial, but the activity supports our charitable mission. We create a clean, prosperous, and secure energy future. Now, the business model, I think, is most interesting out of the 14 entrepreneurial ones we've used successfully, is that we'll use philanthropic funds to create important new intellectual capital. Reinventing Fire itself, 61 people, 6 quarters work. That was a $6 million effort. But then we apply, test, break, fix, refine, and scale that work by collaborating with powerful partners, typically large companies that are very keen to solve a tough problem, and they figure they can do that better with our help. So we learn rapidly together. Their problem gets solved. They pay us a fee for service, which leverages our philanthropic funding. We gain some useful experience and perhaps reputation, but most importantly, we create together, through this collaboration, teachable cases and competitive pressure for emulation. In other words, we help the early adopters get so conspicuously successful that they have to follow, rivals have to follow suit
and
share.
That's your mission. That gets it out in the public, and that's a side venture of what's providing you some economic benefits as well. But the core of it has to come from people who contribute money to you. And the you know, the in an energy business, the big targets would be big oil and big coal, but you're not. They're not candidates for.
Well, you never know. I've worked with the oil industry for 42 years. Some of my colleagues have worked with utilities as long as I have, 30 odd years. You'll find last spring in Public Utilities Fortnightly an 8 or 9 page cover story on how our work has worked out correctly in. You know, that's what's happening in the industry now.
So you're getting money from the energy companies?
Generally, only on a consulting, not a charitable basis. And we have a lot of other major clients, including Walmart. We've worked with them on both truck and store efficiency. And
is this a contribution or is this a contract?
That's a contract.
Who are your contributors?
They're they're almost all listed in our annual report. There are a few that want anonymity, we're completely transparent, and we have very diverse supporters from all. You see, our work is trans-ideological.
Excuse me, Amory. I've got to take a quick break. We'll come right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our guest is Amory Lovins, and we're talking about his book, Reinventing Fire. He's been careful to tell me that he didn't write this book by himself, all of which is a part of his optimistic message that if we do the right things, we can we can avoid the energy emergencies that we've anticipated and can be both self-sustaining and efficient in our energy use by 2050.
And do that, by the way, at a pace of adopting efficiency by 2030 that the Pacific Northwest states already achieved a decade ago. So whatever exists is possible.
So if the rest of us will adopt that level of efficiency and do some other things. Before we quit, tell us about how you see 2050 in terms, first of all, if we've got time, we'll do both usage and sources. But how do you see the source what will we be using to power our needs in 2050?
About three-quarters renewables compared to about an eighth now. And it would be largely a mixture of wind and photovoltaics for electricity. We did not assume solar process heat, but we probably should have. The buildings will largely be thermally passive, that is, they heat and cool themselves, which we have demonstrated in climates from minus 47 to plus 115 with excellent economics. And the efficiency overall would triple. It would about quadruple for using electricity. The amount of renewables would quintuple. The amount of gas would go down by a third. We would be off oil, coal, and nuclear because they can't compete with that other stuff. The rates of doing this are historically reasonable. And the policy changes you need don't require anything from Congress. But I think the main reason it's going to happen is not just the great economics. It's the $5 trillion cheaper part, but that it's trans-ideological. If you want profits, jobs, competitive advantage, or if you care about national security, or if you care about environmental stewardship and creation care and public health and climate protection. If you want any one or more of those things, you could support Reinventing Fire's transition without having to like every outcome and without having to agree about which outcome is most important.
That message is most welcome in Chapel Hill, and we appreciate you bringing it.
Thank you, sir.
Amory Lovins, the author of Reinventing Fire. Thanks, Tim, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.